tonight at 7:05 at Simmons Field. Now the forecast from the National Weather Service on this Wednesday, August 8th. Partly sunny till late afternoon, then clearing, a high of 80. Overnight, clear and mild, a low of 65. Thursday, partly sunny, 40% chance of rain tomorrow. That's what we had yesterday, and boy, we got a lot of rain yesterday afternoon. Tomorrow's high, 86. Right now, wind from the north-northwest at 4, humidity 93%, 68 degrees Kenosha, 66 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees, transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information available at carthage.edu/admission/transfer. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Recently, Carthage College was the site of an extraordinary 2-week event under the auspices of the National Endowment for the Humanities, an institute titled Women's Suffrage in the Americas. It gathered together a number of scholars from all around the Western Hemisphere to study and compare the way in which women's suffrage emerged or was achieved in all of the countries of North and South America. The event was the brainchild of Dr. Patricia Harms, Associate Professor of History, Gender, and Women's Studies at Brandon University in Brandon, Manitoba, and Dr. Stephanie Mitchell, Professor of History at Carthage. On the last day of the Institute, I had the opportunity to visit with some of the women who participated in this incredible event, including Dr. Mitchell. I asked her to explain exactly who had gathered for this Institute.
Well, we're a group of 47 scholars, and that group is divided among what are called National Endowment for the Humanities Summer Scholars and people who are called visiting faculty to the Institute. So the visiting faculty are people that Patricia Harms and I invited to try and answer this broad question of how women in the Americas obtained the suffrage. We invited into the project with the realization that no one has sufficient knowledge in her head to answer the question alone. We really needed some sort of collaborative model in order to interrogate this question. So we put together a group of 18 international scholars from across the hemisphere to begin to answer the question and produce a book, so which has not been produced yet. So each person is writing a manuscript and is part of this collaborative project. What the NEH allowed us to do was to bring all of those scholars together with 30 summer scholars. So these are other scholars who have expertise not only in suffrage in Latin America, but in political science, in literature, in history, of various countries in the America, all who manage in some way this question of gender and gender history and women's history, to bring them into the conversation. So what we did was we designed a very intensive 2-week series where each day we would touch on a set of aspects of this question about how women got the suffrage and collaboratively try and answer the question, talk about how it's going to work. We've divided the question up into categories. So what we're trying to do is classify the national histories into groups in order to understand the question better. And much of our work has been interrogating those categories together with all of our knowledge joined together.
And I'm assuming that it isn't so much that this has not been studied. It's not that nobody has ever thought about how women's suffrage emerged in these various countries, as much as it's not been looked at collectively or collaboratively. I mean, that someone who understands the answer to that question in Brazil has maybe not sat down before with somebody from Argentina or something to compare those stories. Is that part of what happened here at this institute?
That's correct. Although I'd like to qualify that by saying that there are national contexts in which we lack even a national narrative. So the first thing that we did was try to establish some of the variety inside of the historiography, countries that have been more studied, such as the United States, with countries that have really been understudied, to point out how much work is really left to do. But yes, broadly speaking, what's new about our project is that we are looking at this story in the same context that the people felt it to be occurring when it was happening, which is to say, hemispherically.
And by the way, is women's suffrage the reality in every Latin American country?
You have asked a very interesting question that I'm afraid I couldn't answer very succinctly. Right? De jure, women's suffrage is recognized throughout the hemisphere. But the question of how effective that suffrage is really something that we have yet to answer.
Interesting. Professor Stephanie Mitchell, professor of history here at Carthage and co-director of this NEH Institute on Women's Suffrage in the Americas. Thank you for getting us started, and maybe we'll hear from you again in a little bit. I want to direct a question or two to Teresa Novais, who is a professor at the University of Brasilia and from Brazil. And so, for instance, you came to this institute to present at least some of the story of women's suffrage in your own country. So summarize what you think is most important for our listeners to know about the story of women's suffrage in Brazil. And is it a recent history? What would the story be in Brazil in terms of how long the fight for women's suffrage occurred?
Well, the first wave of suffragists appeared in public life at the end of 19th century, and they became struggling for the right to vote until 1932, when they were granted by the then President Vargas, but Vargas wouldn't give them women the right to vote if they did not ask for that. They didn't mobilize themselves and put arguments convincing enough so that politicians would think that, wow, that is fair now to stop this ongoing discussion and do justice to women and give them the right to participate in public life. But the integration in the partisan politics is an ongoing process that never ends. We've just had a president, a woman, and she was deported. She was taken from power, and it's kind of disappointing for many of us. And in many terms, she was misjudged and by the fact that she was a woman in power. So, and also, as I said, the integration of women in the parties, it requires our attention and not vigilant to not to be put aside or non-important for the politics. So we need to speak about the past, understand how hard it was to get the vote, get the right to vote, in order to fuel the current generation in their struggle to remain important in politics.
So in other words, when we talk about the whole story of women's suffrage, it's not just about the moment the women are granted the vote, but then beyond the right to vote, are they welcomed in the political process? Are they allowed to be a meaningful part of it? And it sounds like in Brazil, as in many, many places, that struggle has only begun.
Yes, our professional, we are professionals, we delve into the past, but what people in the current moment do with the knowledge that we produce, that we do, it's what they want. It's at the moment. So they can use our ideas and the examples that we give in order to reshape their strategies by learning from mistakes in the past or having heroes, heroines in their lives, being motivated to keep on wanting to be part of the politics.
Mm. So to derive inspiration from certain figures who have been part of the struggle.
That's it. Inspiration is a good word, and inspiration comes hand in hand with motivation, I think so.
Mm. Nicely put. Teresa Novais is a professor at the University of Brasilia.
Thank you.
And now I'm pleased to be speaking with two of the participants in the institute that just finished up at Carthage College, the institute under the National Endowment of the Humanities, an institute on women's suffrage in the Americas. Daniela Traldi is a PhD candidate at the City University of New York Graduate Center, studying history there. And Francesca Vassallo, originally from Italy, teaches at the University of Southern Maine in Portland and teaches political science. And so I want to hear from each of these women about what drew them to be participants to come and attend this institute. Let's start with Daniela Traldi. What in your own background or previous studies sort of led you to want to be part of this institute?
Well, I'm very interested into this topic. Women's suffrage in the Americas, not only because I did my master's on a similar topic, I studied the transnational history of Brazilian feminism, but also because I'm expected to start teaching very soon. And I realized that in our university, that sort of course still needs to be developed.
It doesn't exist at the moment.
Yes.
Wow.
So it needed like the perfect opportunity to find like-minded people who actually are experts in the field to help me and work in a collaborative mode and try to find like the best questions and answers for a potential course. So I'm working on that. I'm working on drafting a syllabus on women's suffrage in the Americas and beyond, perhaps.
Hmm.
And also like having the opportunity to actually just interact with experts and scholars in each and every field, because they're also experts in countries, in specific countries in the region, has been very illuminating for example, me, at a very early stage of my PhD, think of a potential dissertation topic, which is here. I mean, I just don't know yet, but I mean, ideas have flourished throughout this past few weeks. So it's been very, very illuminating and amazing. I'm just very honored to be here.
Hmm. So in other words, you've heard all kinds of presentations on all kinds of different topics related to various Latin American nations and this story of women's suffrage, and from any number of them you could draw a really fertile topic that could be the focus of your own doctoral dissertation.
Exactly.
And among many things, this experience has been valuable for that.
Yeah, exactly. And not only do that, but think comparatively what has been already done in scholarly terms. So, for example, Stephanie Mitchell, one of our co-directors, was mentioning that some national histories still need to be told. But we also came to the conclusion that some national histories that have already been told have not been translated to English.
Ah, so they're unknown stories.
And the other way around as well. Like, we would need perhaps more translations into Spanish and Portuguese of local U.S. histories, Canadian history, Mexican history, and so on and so forth. So it's being like, you see, a full circle of interaction that still needs to be done.
And so everybody in the hemisphere knows each other's stories, or is in a position to know each other's stories, in addition to your own.
To a certain extent, right? Because we're still working on it.
Right.
I wouldn't say that we know it all. I mean, so many questions emerge that we kind of like figure that's still like lots of work still needs to be done.
Right, but what an exciting opportunity, and this institute was a way to get started on doing that.
Exactly, extremely exciting, and I'm really hoping that we can actually get together again as a group and continue with the conversation.
That would be terrific.
Yeah.
Francesca Vassallo, originally from Italy, now teaches political science at the University of Southern Maine. What in particular was of interest to you to be part of this experience and event?
When I read the call for possible applications to this institute, I was really intrigued by the focus that it had on women's suffrage, because I personally have not really seen in my career any type of conference or program that focuses on such type of topic. And I'm a political scientist. I do comparative politics, so I do plenty of countries out there. And often I talked about voting turnouts. We compare voting turnouts across countries to try to understand whether or not a country is considered to be more democratic than another based upon the level of participation of citizens in the country. However, in my subfield, in political science, often we fail to talk about suffrage. We mention when suffrage was granted or conquered, as we said, but we really don't spend too much time talking about women's suffrage in specific countries or across continents and how important it was for the quality of democracy in the country or the continent. So when I saw the call for this summer institute, I thought this was going to be a great opportunity for me to get access to an excellent group of scholars and researchers, be exposed to very good knowledge sharing about the topic of women's suffrage. And in my view, after spending 2 weeks here, I would call this a graduate program in women's suffrage, because you get so many different perspectives from so many different countries, and each individual scholar contributes based upon his or her own specialty. And that really is top notch, I have to say, whenever I've gone to any conference. So that was excellent for me to come here, because now this fall, when I teach theories of democratization or I teach intro to comparative politics, I will be able to share with my students the type of knowledge of women's suffrage I obtain here. And I will have my students think about this more in depth during their assessment of democracies out there.
Right. And I guess part of what you're saying is that a representative government or democracy is only as good as the level of participation of its citizens. And even in a country where women officially have the right to vote, mm-hmm. if very few women are able to mm-hmm. or inclined to exercise that right to vote, then you aren't where you want to be as a healthy democracy. Did you get a sense out of this institute in terms of what the level of women's participation is in general in Latin America?
One of the initial ratings we completed in this institute was about the very first cases where women's suffrage passed. And that happened to be at the country level, New Zealand, in 1893. So in New Zealand, women's suffrage passed. And within 10 weeks, actually, women there have the opportunity to cast their first national vote. 80% of women in New Zealand registered to vote, and 80% of them actually voted on election day.
Wow.
That is an excellent voting turnout for women.
Would be the envy of most countries.
In 1893.
Wow.
And so that is the type of benchmark, I think, that we need to put in our heads when we talk about voting turnouts and women today, because we already know that women generally represent at least 50% of the population in most democracies. More often than not, they actually are 50%, we have to say. But yet, they do not tend to vote as often as men. Many different reasons have been presented to explain why, but still, there isn't really any type of consensus about what is the problem. But now that we know that women in the past, way back, without any special access to education, without any special means of transportation, without any special type of organization, registered and voted, I think that type of inspiration can be used today to convince a lot more women of all generations to register and vote and participate in any democracy in any way they want to.
Mm. In some ways, that was probably a moment, at least the way it played in New Zealand, where they realized how precious this right was to vote and did not take it for granted in the way that far too many women and men both tend to take that for granted. Certainly here in the United States, we see so much of that. So this institute's been valuable for you in terms of learning more about this?
Absolutely so. And actually, I think before coming here, I was focusing primarily on Latin American countries because that's where most of the scholars at the Institute come from. But we actually talked a lot also about other cases. We talked about Europe a little bit. We talked about the Philippines. We started mentioning maybe possibilities for other countries where it's not clear how women are encouraged to vote. That may be the official constitutional article on eligibility to vote. But in the end, some countries are not very interested in supporting women's enfranchisement. And that has to do a lot with how do you support women's education? How do you support women literacy, for example, which is an intrinsic part of women's suffrage. You know, if, you know, women have to cast a vote, obviously women need to be able to read, especially today. It's so important, not only because of the action of voting, but because of the action of deciding. You know, you have to make a choice.
Right.
In order to make a choice, it has to be, obviously, an informed choice. So we want everyone, both men and women, to get information before voting, to be informed about what they want to vote about, what is important to them personally.
Right, and to have the means to take in that information.
Absolutely.
Or to seek it out.
Absolutely, because generally the more they know, the more they're likely to vote. That's what we've seen overall.
So in a sense, women's literacy is a very critical component here, and it's not one we always think of, but we need to connect those two very much. Wow. Francesca Vassallo teaches at the University of Southern Maine in Portland. Daniela Traldi is a PhD candidate at CUNY Graduate Center. Good to have both of you here. I'm so glad you could come to Carthage and be part of the Institute for Women's Suffrage in the Americas. And thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you, Greg.
And now I'm happy to be speaking with Susan Goodyear, who teaches women's history at the State University of New York at Oneonta. And she has done a great deal of study on the topic of women's suffrage in the United States and the rich, complicated history, and also has studied and written about the vociferous efforts of certain men, many men, and maybe some women too, for that matter, who knows, to fight the notion of women's suffrage. And that is also a story that probably is not told as much as it needs to be. Susan Goodyear, we welcome you to the morning show. I want you to explain what drew you to come to this particular event, because you actually could have taken your expertise to a lot of different places, but there was something about this particular event and its focus that was especially appealing to you.
Well, yes, thank you, and thank you for inviting me to speak with you today. I came here because when I was in graduate school, I began studying social movements of women across borders outside of the United States. I had originally thought that I would do something with international gender and culture, and I got into the topic that I ended up doing, which was anti-suffrage. And you have to stop somewhere, right? But I did. I finished my dissertation, defended, and then went back and got another master's degree in women's studies, and there I focused on transnational women's movements. So I did some papers and some groundwork and a lot of reading, but as I said, I went into a different direction with the writing. And so now that the two books are done, I'm able to begin thinking about my next step. And the best way to do that is to be able to participate in something like the National Endowment for the Humanities and their women's suffrage in the Americas. So for me, it was very, very logical and very connected to goals I had and need to kind of wrap up with a bow.
Very good. You mentioned that one of your two previous books is titled No Votes for Women, and it was a study of the anti-suffrage movement in New York State,
yes,
specifically. And it probably has to be a very brief capsule summary of what I'm sure is a very rich, complicated story. But maybe what would be most interesting and surprising to the general citizen in terms of what the anti-suffrage movement was about? Was it just a bunch of curmudgeonly male chauvinist pigs who just didn't want women to have this new right, or was there something more complicated at the heart of their resistance to this notion?
A way lot more complicated than that, because I only studied the women who organized to prevent their getting the right to vote.
Really?
Only women, yes, because when I was heading in the direction of my graduate work, my graduate studies, I ran across, in fact, almost fell over a publication called The Woman's Protest. And I looked at it and it said, against suffrage and feminism and socialism and all these other things, right? And I said, what is that? And so once I began to look into that and answer that question for myself, I wanted to answer the question, what's the big deal? Why would anybody organize against their own rights?
Right. Why would women do that?
Yes. And it's all about women. And so that's the first thing that's very surprising. The second thing that I think that's very surprising, well, I guess I should say, my goal was to treat their ways of thinking with respect. I did not want to denigrate them.
Even though it's easy to think of them now as on the wrong side of history.
Sure, that everything is black and white,
right?
That it's a Manichaean situation. They've got to be the bad ones. Well, they're not. And they knew each other, and they spent time together. They sometimes attended the same social functions with suffragists. Hmm. Sometimes they were in the same families.
Wow.
But the point is that they believed that women could change things by using typically women's ways. And if you think about history, you'll see women have helped to change the fact that there were no nurses, that there wasn't care for people who were in prisons, that there was no care for orphans. Women have taken over those areas. Social work, of course, is very much women's work. But women have different ways of being and functioning in the world than men do. For these women, the vote was quintessentially male, very often linked with military, big participation in the army, and that would turn them into men, and they wanted to remain women. And then, of course, there are other arguments and things like, well, they're conservative, they want to preserve the home as the center of women's functions in her life. And there were also those who were prejudiced, racial. They wanted to keep immigrant women from voting, black women from voting. So there was that piece, too. But for many, especially of the early women that were involved in the anti-suffrage movement, they really wanted to preserve what was they saw as being wonderful about being women.
Right.
Powerful about being women.
Right. And I suppose that's maybe something, too, where they felt like that was not being sufficiently appreciated. And they were afraid that might, in fact, be diminished.
That's absolutely.
A very important aspect.
Absolutely.
Fascinating. Was the work of anti-suffragist women done in concert with men who also opposed women's suffrage, or by and large were these anti-suffrage efforts in terms of gender segregated? I mean, were they separate efforts?
That's an excellent question, and it actually changes over time. In the beginning, anti-suffragists prided themselves on being a women's organization for women only. What they saw as protecting women's rights.
Right.
Over time, and I think as the suffrage movement gained power and authority and attention from the legislatures, but also in New York, it's based on a referendum, so attention from voters as well. Men began to be involved, and in about 1913, so the anti-suffragists organized in maybe 1894 in New York, 95, and so it takes until about 1912, 13, 14, around in there, the men, and there's a couple of men who become involved in this, and they form the Men's League to Oppose Women's Right to Vote, or some long name, and they begin to appropriate the women's resources, and they begin to take over. And they do, when they do, it actually turns into a far more shrill and ugly movement. Hmm. Before, it was more like two political parties who had opposing views. When the men become involved, it turns nasty in New York, turns nasty, and they begin to really take over. But you notice that it's also just before World War I, and the changes that take place because of the influence of World War I also take these women in a different direction.
Fascinating. Wow. That's an aspect of this whole story that most of us just don't know anything about. And again, I want to remind people that the title of your book that is about this is called No Votes for Women. I want to take a couple of minutes to talk about this, one of the matters at this institute that drew you here, namely this notion of transnational cooperation. Explain to our listeners what the significance of that is and its significance to you in terms of some of the future research that you want to do.
Right, thank you again. Great questions, I love them. The transnational piece, and transnational is a word people don't always fully, what's the difference between transnational, international,
global,
all these things. And essentially, with these transnational movements, the idea is that there's crossing in both directions, in multi directions, sometimes simultaneously, so that it's not just, say, women from the United States going to Puerto Rico or going to Mexico or going to Argentina and imposing their perspective on them. That would be maybe more what we would mean if we said international. These movements, there's more connections. There's also complicated by race, by ideas about what genders are supposed to do in individual countries. It's very, very complicated. But I love that complication. And that's what I was trying to get at here, to kind of unpack some of those complicated relationships and to see the agency from these women that are leaders within their own countries, in Argentina, in Chile, in Peru, wherever they are, Colombia, wherever they are, and how they handled the move that happens in about 1920 of women in the United States moving out into directions that kind of impose the model of U.S. women and U.S. feminism on countries where that doesn't really go very well.
Mm.
And so I wanted to know the resources, the kinds of, what do I need to think about in terms of race and gender and class and all of these intersectional ideas. I wanted to know about those to better inform my work. And that's really why I'm here. We've brought in the organizers, Stephanie and Patty, have brought in people from literally all over this hemisphere. There's nothing like this in my knowledge. It's better than grad school.
And it sounds like you have the beginning of a third book that
yes.
is going to be maybe as interesting as anything you've written. Susan Goodyear is with the State University of New York at Oneonta, and thank you so much for your contribution to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
And it looks like we will be finishing out with one more participant in this recently concluded National Endowment of the Humanities Institute at Carthage called Women's Suffrage in the Americas with Ellie Walsh, who teaches at Governors State University, which is located just south of Chicago. And what do you teach there?
I teach history. I'm a Latin Americanist historian, so I teach history courses on Latin America, but I also teach a course on U.S. women's history, and I teach courses related to gender and sexuality studies. So this seminar appealed to me in many ways, right?
I was going to say, it seemed like a match made in heaven.
A great intersection, right? So I was interested in it both in terms of how it would enrich my understanding of U.S. women's suffrage, because I'm not a U.S. historian. I know more about suffrage in Latin America, but I wanted to also expand what I do know about Latin American suffrage history. And my work itself focuses on the Caribbean, on Puerto Rico in particular, and the process of Americanization in Puerto Rico, so that work has looked at issues of race, class, and gender. What reforms did U.S. Protestant missionaries attempt to bring into Puerto Rico? How did Puerto Ricans respond to them? And so those kinds of intersections are what this seminar was all about. And I particularly wanted to use it in terms of being able to incorporate suffrage in a broader context than the United States for work in the classroom, because I love teaching and I wanted to strengthen my teaching.
Mm. Sounds like a rich opportunity to do exactly that. So maybe you can offer something of an overview that we haven't quite had yet in terms of everybody I've talked to. It's been more specifically directed at particular people and their own interests and backgrounds and so on. But now, as this 2 weeks is over, how would you summarize the overall story of women's suffrage in Latin America, for instance? I mean, is it a struggle that played out completely differently from the way it played out here in the United States, for instance? Or is it that each of these countries has their own story that is so unique that generalizations are impossible or meaningless to make?
Well, I wish I were capable of giving a full answer to that, but that's beyond my means, because that was the goal, as you know, of the seminar, and we're in the process of still processing that and trying to figure it out. But some of the things I think that everybody will agree with is that there were certain patterns that are seen in most, many cases in Latin America that are similar to how things played out in the United States. For example, one of them being particular ideologies, understandings of what being a woman meant, right? Was it associated with motherhood, the private sphere? And the issue of suffrage, of course, brings into that debate what is the role of women in the public sphere, right? So is, for women getting the vote, is it bringing them, many of the people who were against suffrage in both Latin America and the United States said that it brought women out of their proper sphere, which was the home. Some suffragists in both Latin America and the United States said, you know, chose to say that, no, it's expanding women's domestic sphere, because women would be able to bring that same moral authority that she exercised in the home into the public sphere, and therefore clean up corrupt politics, and that women were concerned about issues, family issues, education of children, health of children, and that so suffrage would allow them to have power in terms of policy in those areas. I think we would all agree, though, that how that particular debate about what it meant to be a woman and the role of mother and family played out differently. That's one significant difference between the United States and Latin America, that more Latin American women argued for suffrage on the basis of women's role as mother than did in the United States. In other words, some people in the United States debated that, but Latin Americans saw it differently, and actually there was often tension between some U.S. suffragists and Latin American suffragists, because some U.S. suffragists thought that the Latin Americans were overly concerned with what they saw was an understanding of womanhood that kept women back.
Interesting.
Right.
I mean, not that I know anything about this specifically, but for instance, a figure like Susan B. Anthony, she's probably an example of somebody for whom personally none of those traditional women's roles was not important to her. Her place was not in the home, in the kitchen or whatever.
Right.
She was never a mother and so on. So for instance, for somebody like her, chances are she would have greeted this sort of rhetoric from some of these other suffragists with maybe some, at least, suspicion or wariness.
You're absolutely right, you know, and at the same time, I mean, which shows some of the contradictions of these and the complexities of this issue. I mean, her partner in this project of suffrage was Stanton, had several, I don't know, six children. I said,
right,
you know, so she's trying to juggle, but you're right. You can pick up on the tension, the impatience between Anthony, you know, and Stanton around this issue.
In some ways, they represent the same tension that you're talking about between, in general, the United States suffragist movement and the suffragist movement as it played on some of these Latin American countries.
Yeah, that's a very astute observation. And we did. We were just discussing, I think it was today or yesterday, that one of the patterns you see is that for some, particularly for the middle class elite women in both the United States and Latin America, how so many of them were single women.
Mm.
So, and part of that maybe had to be about that choice of, you know, could they juggle those roles, or what did those roles mean to them? And Latin American women on a whole, particularly working class Latin American women involved in the fight for the struggle for suffrage, found much less dichotomy. I mean, you know, they were like, no, this is part of our role. There was never this idea that, you know, that being a mother would mean they would have to sacrifice their participation in the struggle. They saw it just integral to their understandings of themselves as individuals and as women, right? So one other pattern I would say that we saw, but we've struggled with, you know, exactly how to categorize it, is the key role of what the political structure is and what's going on in terms of political competition between existing parties, right? So that in many cases there were situations where legislatures that were male and political parties, primarily male, or at least the power in the hands of men, when would they agree to suffrage? Sometimes it's because when there was political gain for them, right? Such as in Puerto Rico, to enfranchise women, particularly illiterate women, the working class women who were predominantly illiterate, was going to be a great advantage to the Socialist Party, right? And one other common thread that I found very interesting is that many times politicians' decisions about granting the vote to women was based on, some of them feared that women were too susceptible to the sway of the Catholic Church and would do just what the priest said. So, of course, for some parties, that's going to help them, right?
Some may see
that as a positive, others as a negative. So that same ideology about women being conservative and not independently minded could be used by different sides,
right, so
to argue either side, just like the role of woman as mother.
Right. So depending on who was in power at the time and how they saw this as potentially a loss or a gain for their side.
Right.
That might play into it as much as, or more so than what they might philosophically have believed themselves.
Exactly. Right. So some of it's about instrumentalism,
yeah.
Right?
Wow.
And not about personal beliefs or values, right?
Right.
And I think it's a good lesson in like the plasticity of ideology, right? It can be used, employed, manipulated by many sides.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we often think of that happening today. We don't always think about it happening a century ago,
right.
For instance.
Yeah, right.
Something I did not realize until I did a little research ahead of these interviews today was I was curious to find out in 1920 when that amendment passed that finally gave all women in the United States the right to vote. At that point in time, were there some women who already had the right to vote? And I was really curious to know that. I had no idea, and studied that and found out that there were a number of states that have
right,
already granted
in cities,
that.
Which, yeah.
But what I was really struck to by the complexity of it, that in some places the women could only vote in presidential elections, or in others in only state elections, or
right.
local
municipal
elections.
Right.
And in some states it varied city to city. And
right.
I had
and in
no
some of those it would be only literate women who could do it.
Ah,
and, right?
That I didn't know.
Yeah, or some they had to be married, or they had to have a certain amount of property. So, I mean, that's been one of the challenges of this seminar, is that what does it even mean, like, who got the vote? What did the vote mean? Because
right.
it varies at each level.
Exactly. That there's this, yeah, and,
right.
and sometimes it's a complete, across the board, complete total suffrage, and in other cases it's very much qualified. I was curious if, in this respect, if the story of women's suffrage is similarly complex in these Latin American countries,
oh.
or are they, or in many cases, are these countries small enough and homogenous enough that you wouldn't quite see such a wide
no,
variation?
No, they're just as complex, and it's interesting to see that actually size didn't determine the complexity, right? So Guatemala is relatively small, say, in comparison to Mexico, certainly, or Brazil, or in Puerto Rico, right? Very small. Yet within those, there were still the divisions of class around race or ethnicity, particularly around indigenous, whether you were Indian or mixed, the class difference and the rural urban divisions, right? So all of those, and certainly the class and what the economic structure was in the country, all led to these complexities, even in small physical places. I mean, in Guatemala, there's more than 20 indigenous languages. You know, even today, 50% of Guatemalans do not speak Spanish, right? So you can imagine how that excluded them from some of the formal political sphere, and fed in and both helped constitute and represent the divisions among Guatemalan people at large.
So looking back over these 2 weeks, what do you feel like is the single most important benefit that you have enjoyed just by being here and being a part of this?
Well, you know, one is that to have all together in one space some of the these brilliant scholars from Latin America, from Canada, from the United States, to be in one place and be able to exchange ideas and to share expertise, right? And particularly, one of the strengths of this has been that it's interdisciplinary, so that we're predominantly historians, but there's political scientists, language and literature people also. So I think it's so important too that we're not only having people from the Americas in conversation with each other, but across disciplines also, which has presented problems of, you know, challenges in terms of language, how do you understand things. But that's so important. I mean, we can't really answer the big questions that this seminar has so ambitiously, you know, presented without having different voices, both in terms of geographic and cultural perspective, but in terms of disciplinary perspectives, right? And the kinds of conversations that we've had are just amazing. I mean, we're all talking about it. In some ways, we're mentally exhausted, but because of the richness and the rigor, right?
It's the happiest kind of exhaustion.
It is the best kind of exhaustion.
Ellie Walsh teaches at Governor State University, and thank you so much for being part of the morning show. It's great to talk to you.
And thank you for being so interested in our work here. I appreciate that.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I look forward to sharing with you an interview with Bill Schneider, formerly the senior political analyst with CNN.